You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Get a break on.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, September 19th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America.
The America.
Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Sean Fay, author of The Transgender Issue, Trans Justice is Justice for All. Then later in the program, Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota's 5th Congressional District. She's also the Democratic whip in the House. We'll be talking to her about sundried issues.
The Congressional Progressive Caucus whip, right? Yeah.
The Congressional Progressive Caucus whip, excuse me.
It's Monday.
Yes. Meanwhile, speaking of saying things mistakenly, Joe Biden says the pandemic is over. Apparently, COVID has a slightly different analysis. Puerto Rico, slammed by Hurricane Fiona, now completely without power. Still haven't apparently fixed the power grid on that island. More details on DeStuntis's immigrant fraud, as DHS agents may have falsified information to abet that little fraud. NBC generic poll, Democrats and Republicans neck and neck. Republicans with a slight edge in enthusiasm, however. Biden administration is now quietly looking to close Guantanamo Bay. The budget deadline looms. Democrats are seeking $12 billion more in Ukraine aid, bringing America's total to $60 billion so far and counting in providing such military aid to Ukraine. Manchin's rider is being fashioned. May have a question for Congresswoman Omar about that. And remember that Supreme Court independent state legislator theory case? So ominous? Well, it turns out it is completely built upon what just about every historian considers a completely fraudulent document. DOJ appeals to the 11th Circuit for access to Trump's stolen documents to continue their investigation. Russia bombing dangerously close to that Ukrainian nuclear power plant as it seeks to damage Ukrainian infrastructure. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is Monday. It is the beginning of the week. It is also, well, I don't want to jump ahead of myself. With me, as always, Emma Vigeland, who today is also now ESVN Day.
It is, yes. So we're moving to Mondays. I think it's a little bit better. No conflict with Left Reckoning, right? If you want to enjoy.
Yeah, I kind of flexed some muscle and said, you got to get off my turf.
It was a seniority thing.
I told us to stop.
But it just makes more sense with the NFL season and also, like, Tuesdays are really busy days if you work in political media, if there's primary days and things like that.
Yep.
Although that's largely past. But the Giants are 2-0. 2-0. So it'll be a fun show today. They're probably the worst 2-0 team in the league, but they are 2-0. 2-0.
And the Jets won. We're going to be so insufferable.
I know.
Someone I heard today on the radio that Sunday was the first time in like 15 years that the Jets, Giants, Yankees, and Mets won.
Oh, all together. Yep. Wow. Yeah. Well, it's been a while since the Jets and Giants won at all. So pretty
incredible. Favorite part, my favorite moment was from last week when Matt just looked at you two and goes, Mondays.
Mondays. Right.
All right,
that's all that needs to be said.
Let's get into it. We got a lot to get to today. I'm not going to lie. There's not a lot of deep analysis that we can offer for this next clip. It is. I also want to make this clear. It is not doctored. For some reason, at one point during Trump's speech in Ohio, this is the one where he's there to help J.D. Vance in Ohio. It really does seem like it's one of the few places, too, where, I mean, I guess he's gone down to Arizona and I guess maybe Pennsylvania. So he's going around to where these big Senate races are. It is unclear as to whether, I mean, they're obviously those candidates are pursuing a strategy of getting their people out in a low turnout, traditionally low turnout election. But it also probably motivates Democrats to go out and vote, as the polling is starting to reflect a little bit. Even with that said, like, I can't explain this at all.
We have a little background, right? Like, there's a background track that is played here. And apparently this was a song made online entitled WWG1WGA, which means where we go one, we go all. And that is a QAnon song. It's a fan QAnon creation.
In other words, Donald Trump has gone all in on the Q thing.
Yeah.
And well, let's just play this and we'll talk about the implications of that. And also, it is extremely revealing about what Republicans have been doing for an extended period of time. Just a slightly different flavor, and it's a little more obvious now to us. But here it is. Donald Trump wrapping up his speech or going, this is the end, right? Because it would be even weirder to do it in the middle. But
anyway, Rosie O'Donnell's really fat.
Here is Donald Trump at the end of his speech trying to make it almost like, I don't know, like the Q Independence Day moment from that movie with Bill Pullman. Here we go.
We are a nation that allowed Russia to devastate a country, Ukraine, killing hundreds of thousands of people, and it will only get worse. It would never have happened with me as your commander-in-chief.
I'll pause it for 1 second. There's a salute that they're doing.
Yeah.
Do we know what that salute is?
I literally just...
It's a one from where we go one.
Oh,
we go
okay.
All.
It is the Q salute.
Is that confirmed, though? Because, like, Will Sommer, who covers QAnon, says he's still not sure what it is and hasn't been able to verify it.
Interesting.
Either way, it's some sort of salute. We just, like, don't...
Yeah.
A little bit...
You're number one. I mean, it's a weird...
Yeah.
There's a couple fingers missing from the entire
thing.
That's what I'm saying. Like, the angle is a little bit troubling, like 45 degrees there.
The fact that it's being widely replicated in a crowd.
But here's the point. It doesn't matter whether it is, like, you know, very reminiscent of the Sieg Heil or not. It is clearly some type of movement that is embedded in this crowd. And that is, you know...
It is a salute.
It is some type of salute.
Yeah, and the fact that even reporters who cover QAnon very closely are like, I'm not exactly sure what it is at this point, don't know. I mean, that means it's just in the bowels of the QAnon conspiracy stuff.
At worst, it would never have happened with me as your commander-in-chief, and for 4 long years, it didn't happen. And China... with Taiwan is next. We are a nation that has weaponized its law enforcement against the opposing political party like never, ever before. We've got a federal bureau of investigation that won't allow bad election-changing facts to be presented to the public, where Hunter Biden's laptop was Russian disinformation when they knew it wasn't.
It's got a bill,
guys. Department of Justice that refuses to investigate.
Can we get the Fantasia soundtrack,
egregious acts
please?
Of voting irregularities and fraud. And we have a president who is cognitively impaired and in no condition to lead our country, which may end up in World War III. We are a nation that no longer has a free press and has no fair press any longer. Fake news is all you get, and they are truly the enemy of the people. We are a nation where free speech is no longer allowed, where crime is rampant like never before, where the economy has been collapsing, where more people died of COVID in 2021 than in 2020. We are a nation that is allowing Iran to build a massive nuclear weapon and China to use
Lady's trying to get in on it behind her. Behind
taken
him.
From us to build
She's
a military
doing more of like a church.
Yeah, the church thing.
And just 2 years
or maybe
ago,
she has to go to the bathroom.
We had Iran, China, Russia,
what, you got a question?
North Korea, and all of the rest in check. They weren't going to do a thing against us, and everyone knows it. They respected the United States, and they respected America.
Goodness gracious.
It sounds like they're trying to play him off. What happened with the Emmys. It's like, all right, wrap this up, buddy.
All right, look. It's hard to play this and not laugh at it. Because it's hilarious, just in terms of like the production values and his inability to actually, like, the music is not suited to this. It doesn't build to a crescendo.
But it is suited to it, is it not?
Well, but here's my point. People should be very concerned about this. Because it doesn't take a lot of people who are in a this type of sort of like death cult to really undermine a society. And, you know, when he has now leaned fully in to the Q thing, because the yield on the people who know what that song is and who know whatever this is, that the pointing of that finger or the salute, the yield of those people who will come out and vote because Donald Trump has activated them is like 1-to-1.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it really is going to come down. I mean, turnout is going to be such a huge issue here. There's no, the persuasion stuff is all well and good, but J.D. Vance is going to get a solid base of lunatic fringe people, and it's going to be self-perpetuating.
Creating a high floor for yourself. I mean, and that's what activating your base does. You create a high floor.
But if J.D. Vance makes it to the Senate, he's going to keep going back to this well. Trump is going to keep going back to this well. It's going to expand it because there's, you know, there's nothing you know, if you're Q adjacent or you were Q and then you were demoralized, this type of stuff has got you back on in a heartbeat. So it is,
because those people dancing around like that, what's the raw material for that is really alienated, like people that are devoid of a community, and they found one now, and it has the Trump imprimatur on it, and it's and he's the leader of it, like, which we all knew he was, but that's really energizing for all those people.
I mean, look, and I've talked about this guy, Bob Altemeyer, who is a professor up at Manitoba University, did 25 years of clinical studies on authoritarianism, and he and his researchers had determined years ago, well before Trump, John Dean used a lot of his work in the books that he wrote in the late aughts and the early teens. 25% of North Americans are right-wing authoritarians. Trump is collecting them and has created a home for them. And with all the accoutrements, the salutes, the music, the, you know, sort of dog whistle stuff, but he's getting a little more explicit because they need to break out. They need to you know, it's all hands on deck right now because they want to take back the Senate. And Trump sees this as, like, you know, his the linchpin to his 2024 chances, too. So that's what's going on here. It is hilarious, but it also should be very, very disturbing to you.
Yeah, I mean, and when he uses that kind of music, it just gives them so much energy. And he says, like, just all they need are little nuggets here and there, and they're primed. These right-wingers and these fascists are primed to see conspiracy in everything. And when you have a guy who knows that and just gives them little bits of life, it's a scary, scary proposition.
And I'll say those aren't nuggets. Those are like full meals.
Yeah.
I don't know what else you're going to get out of that, other than, like, ladies and gentlemen, tonight I introduce Q. And they bring out, you know, Michael Flynn. I have no idea. Got a couple of ads before we get to writer Sean Fay, author of The Transgender Issue. Trans justice is justice for all. I've spoken about Aura quite a bit on this program. There's identity theft is everywhere. Every day I will get some type of phishing notice, either a text or an email. I imagine other people do, too, because it is a crime that is hitting one American every 14 seconds in this country. I like to engage with the people. I got to be honest with you. I got a text message last night. Steve, did you get the documents I sent over? And I'm like, is this Marianne? Because if so, I did not get those documents and I need them ASAP. And then that was all right, but whatever. But I never click on the links. Anyways, even if I did, I use Aura to protect myself. They're one of our sponsors. Aura is identity theft protection, fraud monitoring, and antivirus software all combined into one easy-to-use app. They also basically get those identity search sites also to remove you. They keep consistently requesting that you get removed from those sites. That's also helpful. I don't know why they don't pitch that in this. But you may have one of these services already. But if you don't have all the tools, it's like locking the front door, leaving the back door open, or, I don't know, side window. It doesn't matter. This is how it goes down. You try and log into your email account one day. See the password was changed a couple hours ago from, like, I don't know, whatever town that you don't live in. And then you start getting notifications of activity from your bank and your credit cards. It's scary. And like I say, unfortunately, a reality for Americans every 14 seconds. Aura monitors the dark web for your emails, passwords, social security numbers, and sends alerts fast. They send it right to your phone and to your email. Even when you go and sign up, you put your email in, it will tell you where your passwords have been compromised all around the web. Aura also gives you near real-time alerts on suspicious credit inquiries, like if someone's trying to open up a loan or a credit card in your name. You can protect you and your family from identity theft at aura.com/majority. When you sign up right now, Aura is going to give you 2-week free trial. So you can see for yourself how many times Aura finds you or a family member's personal info on the dark web. Check it out with my link. That's aura.com/majority. And if you sign up, let us know in the comments below if your personal information has been compromised. I promise you, you will not regret checking. Again, that's A-U-R-A, aura.com/majority, and you can try it for free for 14 days. Also, this is just a great product. In fact, I think I started using this before they became ads, just because I saw it on a list of potential advertisers, and I was checking it out. Particularly when you get to be my age, you realize your parents are not going to be around forever, and they aren't necessarily in a position to let you know about their lives. You may have questions as you get older. And this is, I mean, I hate to put it in those stark terms, but this is where I really begin to appreciate this. The product is StoryWorth. And what StoryWorth does is every week it emails your loved one, and you could do this for your parents, uncles, aunts. You could do it with friends, too, if you wanted. You could do it for anybody, I mean, I guess technically. What they do is they email your loved one a thought-provoking question of your choice from a vast pool of possible options, or they'll just do it automatically. It's up to you. Questions that you may never have thought of, like what's your fondest childhood memories, or what's the best advice you ever received, or it could be anything, like, you know, what was your favorite car? You'd be surprised what starts to jog people's memories and gets them to tell stories. You'll end up hearing stories and memories that you never knew anything about, details. Then obviously you can follow up on that if you want. But after 1 year, StoryWorth compiles all those questions and stories, including photos, into a beautiful keepsake book that your whole family can share for generations. This is a great gift ostensibly for somebody else, but it's also one for you, and then it works for a third party, too. I mean, this is like a threefer, because if they're your grandparent, they very likely or possibly somebody else's grandparent, cousins, and so the keepsakes end up giving. The stories are a great way to connect with people. This is just a great product. And it's one of those things that I think you end up appreciating more as time goes on. Get to know your loved ones better and preserve those special moments forever with StoryWorth. Right now, for a limited time, you can save $10 on your first purchase when you go to StoryWorth.com/majority. That's story, S-T-O-R-Y, worth, W-O-R-T-H, StoryWorth.com/majority. To save $10 on your first purchase, StoryWorth.com/majority. As always, we will put links to both those in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to writer Sean Fay, author of the transgender issue, Trans Justice is Justice for All. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us is the writer Sean Fay. She's the author of the transgender issue, Trans Justice is Justice for All. Sean, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
I want to start off with, let's start with the title. The trans issue, you wrote this as, something of a little bit of a Trojan horse. Explain that for us.
Yeah. Well, I kept hearing the phrase, the trans issue, both in the press in my own country, the UK, and also, you know, in American media too. And, if you notice when it's typically used, it's often used to sort of problematize trans people and to kind of erase the complexity. You know, I would be sat there listening to people saying the trans issue, and I'd be thinking, well, that, you mean me, that's my life, at the most core level. And it's a way of abstracting, I think, the complexities of a minority, you know, the challenges facing a minority group, in order to make it seem like a conceptual problem for the rest of society, usually by the right. And so I wanted to kind of take that phrase back and say to people, when you hear this phrase, the transgender issue, you're not hearing about issues facing trans people. You're actually hearing about anxieties in society at large that trans people are perhaps provoking.
You mentioned the media in the UK and the just kind of all-out transphobic blitz that was happening and still is. But, you know, here in the United States, viewing what was happening across the pond over in the UK when TERFs and that kind of ideology was just came to the fore, it really seemed like it was a trial run to do it here in the United States, and now we're seeing transphobia broadly being used to try to galvanize right-wingers to the polls and stir up hatred. What was that like, and how did that start, the transphobic media blitz? And I know that, you know, Rupert Murdoch's companies were involved in that as well here in the United States. It's the same deal.
Yeah, so I think it is frustrating. I think because there's a couple of cultural differences, obviously, between the UK and, for example, the US, in that here, for example, like Christian right objections to LGBT people do not have the same kind of perhaps appeal in the mainstream, like appeals to religious or moral reasons for opposing LGBT people and trans people specifically. But what I felt was happening here in the UK, in terms of what you described as the trial run thing, was here, there was sort of a liberal respectability afforded to transphobia, usually under the guise of like superficially feminism, but quite quickly less of actual feminist argument and more kind of a paternalist reactionary claim to protect women and children, which actually can be a very right-wing form of rhetoric. And so I think what happened around sort of like, we've all always had like issues with transphobia in the media in the UK, like pretty much since trans people have been around for about, you know, over half a century. But in the last like 10 to 5 years, as trans people started to become more visible, and there was a sort of peak visibility moment around the world, often led by the United States and people like Laverne Cox and perhaps Caitlyn Jenner as well, her transition. The backlash in the UK started when we started to look at our gender recognition laws and potentially reforming them and looking at creating a kinder environment for trans people. Is quite quickly the Murdoch media that is very powerful, our tabloid media in this country, certainly traditional conservatives who just don't like LGBT people, and this kind of liberal, respectable transphobia that had persisted in our press kind of coalesced as an odd motley crew and started to in earnest campaign against some of the most like gentle reforms of the law that would help trans people, for example, identify their own gender legally.
I mean, it's interesting because I think that like it sort of feels to me that on some level it went and I want to get to obviously other parts of this, but this is a worthwhile, I think, a topic is that it in this country it became activated after there was marriage equality, and the Obama administration sent out a fairly, I think, a benign reminder to states that Title IX of our Civil Rights Act requires trans people to be able to use bathrooms based upon the way that they identify. And that became, I think, you know, a rally cry for the right wing. And then it seemed to go to the UK and come back in that form that you talk about that was appealing to sort of ostensibly liberals who are concerned ultimately about feminism, they say, but it ends up, like you say, reiterating right-wing talking points. I want to get to that as you get into it a little bit later into the book. So we'll put a pin in that for a minute. But I want to also ask, and this is, again, now that we've gotten past just the title, the first line of your book, "The liberation of trans people would improve the lives of everyone in our society." I mean, that is largely the theme, it seems, of your book, is that the trans liberation brings about a lot of material and, I guess, value to society writ large. Can you talk about that, like in what way?
Yeah, sure. So the idea is common to a lot of liberation politics. Like if you look at like early women's liberation movements like the suffragettes, a lot of black feminist texts, they would say like, you know, the liberation of women generally, the liberation of a black woman, the liberation of gay people in early gay liberation. So yeah, I applied that to trans people, is that with any marginalized group in societies, a society is judged by how it treats the people at the margins, not the people like already near the glass ceiling. And so trans people being one of those groups, you judge a society by how they're treated. And the things that disenfranchise trans people, which is what I'm getting at there, are not primarily the things that are often people think they are in the media, like being misgendered, in your email signature or whatever. And the kind of finer points of workplace inclusion, it tends to be poor housing, community and family rejection, medical inequality and injustice, being forced out of legitimate economies into more dangerous economies like sex work. And so the remedies that need to kind of would be needed in order for, you know, huge numbers of trans people to lead more dignified and joyful lives would be things that would require radical social overhaul for, yeah, everyone, because it requires, for example, a basic standard of living. It requires like housing and a social welfare safety net that is there for anyone for whom generational wealth, family support, community support, school support is just not going to be there. And of course, trans people are a group that slip through the cracks in a late capitalist society that isn't consumed very much with supporting the most vulnerable members. And so I kind of try and say, like, yes, this book is about trans people, but also let's see if trans people are just a microcosm of wider social ills, rather than trans people being the social ill, as the right frame us to be.
And why, I mean, is it that trans folk are almost like the canaries in the coal mine in terms of, or at least representative of, or their issue sets, the material issue sets that they face are just a function of the most politically marginalized in society? I mean, is that ultimately why addressing those material needs for trans people would end up addressing the material needs for a much broader part of society?
Yeah, they are, because, they're not the only canary in the coal mine. There are plenty of groups and you know, different trans people will have different experiences because of, you know, other components of how they're politicized, though, like along the lines of race or class, for example. But I think broadly, yes, it would be fair to say that, like, trans people, especially in the time we're living in, are kind of a canary in the coal mine. Like, even if you look at, like, the question of medical inequality and trans people's bodily autonomy, I think with regards to what has happened with Roe versus Wade, I think it's very clear that when you start to have arguments based on curbing a group, a minority group's bodily autonomy on the basis that it's somehow immoral, or it's like playing with things that shouldn't be played with, or it's not people's destiny, or that gender should be a certain way, it's not very long until that slips both into homophobia and to misogyny. And I think it's very clear to see the connection in the US, for example, between the attack on trans people and the attack on women generally. And then I think with regard to gender itself being such a powerfully organizing principle of how we structure our society, of course, in many ways, like people think of bathrooms and so on, but right down to like our system of incarceration, the fact that trans people's very existence threatens this, you can either see trans people as like a bug in this sort of system, or you can start to wonder whether or not they're actually exposing a flaw in the system as a whole. And so, for example, with regards to mass incarceration, the problems where you look at, like, how do we accommodate trans people within the present system of incarceration, the liberal response that someone like, I don't know, Kamala Harris might espouse, the problem there is that actually you're looking for a more humane option in a system that's fundamentally inhumane. So I'm interested in using trans people to expose the inhumanity in wider systems of oppression and discrimination.
Well, let's and I want to get to that too, actually, because the arguments you hear, I mean, I'm most interested in the arguments that we hear from that, you know, sort of quasi-liberal set that we have imported in some ways from England, because the religious fundamentalists it seems to me their critique or their complaints, I guess, about the existence of trans people is, in many respects, it seems to me almost identical to what it was with the existence of gay people, frankly. But it's a far more ostensibly nuanced critique that I think I want to get to. But let's talk about, like, you in the same way that you say the answer for that question of how do we, you know, accommodate trans people in prisons is also the issue for sex work. Walk us through that and why sex work ends up being one of those, I guess, silos where addressing the issues for trans people is really one that we need to address for everybody.
Okay, well, for example, with sex work, the reason that, I mean, in my book, I devote a whole chapter to sex work. The reason being is that globally, sex work is the largest, you know, trans people are mostly occupied in sex work if you look at a global scale. And even, I think, you know, whether you look in the US or, you know, like when I looked in my own social circle in London, certainly amongst trans women, some participation in sex work was probably more common. It was more common to have done some kind of sex work than to not have. And the reason being for that, so there's two things going on there. Is one, why is sex work so potentially, I want to say appealing, but perhaps like the choice that some trans workers will choose to enter into? It's probably because of disenfranchisement from the so-called illicit economy, from other forms of work where you're likely to encounter all sorts of discrimination. There can be lots of positives in terms of, yeah, freedom from discrimination and other benefits to sex work for some trans sex workers, even though sex work can also be very dangerous. And particularly then the marginalization of sex workers and trans people are intertwined, one, because there's this overlap in the two groups. But also, yeah, that like sex work becomes unsafe because of how we as societies choose to criminalize it, punish it, push it to the margins to make sex workers participate in more and more unsafe working practices. And I think it's a shame that both leftist and feminist analysis often lose sight of the fact that sex workers, both are workers and majoritively are women, and that the response there should be looking at them, their rights in terms of right to work in safety, rather than necessarily looking in a sort of moralistic way about the rights and wrongs of sex work and the people that buy sex, the men that typically buy sex.
So in terms of the kind of the pipeline that is created here, it's a lack of broad acceptance of trans people in society that perhaps pushes them maybe into other industries where or something like sex work, where perhaps they're able to be openly trans, but that it also, I would imagine, does not lead to broader societal acceptance and is more of a fetishization as opposed to like something that's more liberatory.
Yeah, I mean, completely, I agree. Like, look, it's a case of like, if you look at like the, I guess the classic example would be, you know, for example, say a young trans woman, perhaps who doesn't have like strong family ties or family support. You know, it's also the fact that one, you're struggling in the mainstream employment market, if you want to call it that, to get a job at all. And, you know, potentially on where you live, like what rights you might have in that employment and the discrimination you may face by colleagues, customers, whoever, combined with the fact that like healthcare is so expensive, whether we're talking the US or the UK, like that's not accessible to many people. And you're looking at potentially trying to fund healthcare that includes hormones, maybe surgeries to change your body. And that sort of stacks up, and suddenly, like sex work, for example, can become quite appealing in terms of being able to access financial resources, you know, more quickly and in it being a lesser of many evils in terms of the workplace. But then combined with that too, yeah, is the fact that like obviously that does not necessarily lead to greater like social acceptance, and it is often participating in, you know, all the problems that accompany the sex industry, both for the workers and how they're treated, but also, yeah, I guess in terms of how that is, yeah, you're obviously marketing something that can be fetishistic or, yeah. And I guess trans sex workers will have a sort of wide range of feelings about that. But the problem is that, like all of these arguments around sex work, for example, is that if people are uncomfortable with the negative aspects of sex work as an occupation for trans women, trans people, or cisgender women, the answer is like, well, why are people doing sex work? It's because of lack of welfare, lack of financial resources. So if you really, and often, you know, if you look, I suppose the other aspect there is immigration and the fact that we, you know, undocumented workers will often be more likely to turn to sex work. So really it's our system of our immigration system and our poor welfare system in many countries around the world that are responsible for people choosing sex work. And so if you don't like the fact that people are in sex work, it's probably better the choice comes from giving them more resources, I would argue.
You also you have a chapter on the state's role in the issues that face transgender people. Talk a little bit about Section 28. I mean, this is obviously British unique, I guess, English unique. But what role did that play in creating issues, I guess?
Yes, yeah, so I'll just quickly explain. So Section 28 is a law that was passed in the UK, and it, you know, stands for the Local Government Act that section was in, and it was an act about local, like government maintained schools, like, you know, what you would call in the US public schools. And all public schools from 1988 to 2003 were not allowed to promote homosexuality as a pretended family relationship. That's what the legislation said. I was born in 1988, so someone like me, I'm 34 years old. Like pretty much the entire time I was at school, Section 28 was in force. It meant that teachers could not teach positive things about LGBT people. LGBT teachers, gay teachers, could not be out as LGBT at school. If you were being bullied, your teachers were worried about comforting you about it. School libraries could not have books that were positive about LGBT people. It was kind of like an omerta about queer trans identity, full stop, period. And the impact of that, of course, is, you know, as someone that like grew up through that, is that obviously for those young people growing up LGBT at that time, it probably had a really deleterious effect on mental health and personal well-being, because you're coming into a consciousness at school or whatever, and your peers are as well, that you might, you know, have this very, you know, ultimately a minority identity, and the message you're getting is that like actually it's secretive, it's something to be secretive about, and it's shameful. For teachers, of course, it like encouraged homophobia amongst teaching faculty. Many teachers received, you know, who will have qualified, teaching staff who were qualified during the era of Section 28 are still teaching now, and they all picked up all sorts of ideas and never really had them challenged because it didn't form part of their teacher training. So its legacy kind of lived on for quite a long time, I think. And what's distressing, you know, that campaigners in the UK spent a long time campaigning to repeal that law, and it took a long time. What's distressing now is that you see rumours in the UK with our current Conservative government, is that there are campaigners campaigning to basically re-implement that law. They know it's no longer palatable for lesbian, gay and bisexual people, but there are campaigners very vociferously campaigning for British schools to not be allowed to teach anything positive about gender ideology, gender identity, which I would say is code for trans people. I don't really believe there's such a thing as gender ideology. That's the existence of trans people.
We should say that we, you know, I think for a lot of people who hear this, we have a don't say gay law in Florida that is being replicated around the country. And I think that's very much the sort of the similar dynamic. And it's set up in such a way that it is vague enough, and the repercussions of transgressing that law is substantial enough that it begins to self-censor. And that's just at the beginning. And like you say, after a decade or two of living under that regime, it begins to have like a sort of a feedback loop, and you start to see it reflected, I imagine, in teachers and a whole host of other sort of like issues that it creates for kids who have to go through that. But let's talk about this question of trans ideology and move into this question of like where the way that there are two forms, I feel like, of transphobia, or it presents itself in this country anyways right now.
Yeah.
One is the sort of that religious fundamentalism where they don't want any type of divergence from the sort of classic patriarchal roles and hierarchy to be in any way altered. But then there's also this other sort of like burgeoning industry, it feels like, of worrying about a growing movement of trans or gender ideology, that is bringing about sort of like these vague, problems. The problems, and as I hear them articulated, trans women in women prisons, and what they're doing to kids. There's predation and indoctrination, and then also castration and all of these things. And let's walk through these. Now, I know you've addressed the prison thing in saying that the solution is to get rid of the carceral state in many respects. But what is how do you respond to it in the event that that's not happening, right? I mean, that's obviously like a radical change. Like, what is the addressing here? Because when I have engaged with people that they can point to a story or two that they saw where there is a rape that has taken place in a women's prison by a trans woman, but they forget about the problem of prison rape writ large, both for women and for trans women so what is how do we address that issue? And then let's go through some of these, or even calling it I don't know if it's an issue because we don't have real data on this, but it is a complaint or it's an argument.
Yeah, well, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because the thing is that if someone is enacting kind of violent crimes or predatory crimes, the reality is that, like, in an ideal sort of like system, in a prison system, it should be that vulnerable people are protected from predators. And that doesn't matter whether the predator is like a cis man, a trans woman, a cis woman. It shouldn't matter. But the reality is that what is, this is a criticism of the prison system. I just have to say this, is that obviously you can have, the prison system is a complex thing where we put together people who can be both abuser and abused, people who, people who have not committed violent crime with people who have committed, violent crime. And so prison is inherently an unsafe place, and I think... Yeah, I mean, I'm never going to argue that, like, vulnerable people should be put at risk by a trans prisoner. That's not, like, what I believe. It's not the right thing. What I'm interested in, I think, is how that, instances of where that can happen, and that can happen, is used rhetorically to make broad-sweeping policies around a group for whom the prison experience itself, and we're talking particularly about trans women, trans people generally, but trans women, is extremely brutal, is extremely violent. And usually, like, in certainly in my country, that has been used, these sort of like hard cases have been used to make broader arguments about self-identification of gender, depathologizing the process by which you change your legal sex generally for everyone. Whether inside prison or outside prison, because it's this idea that, like, if we allow me to change my my gender without a psychiatrist report, essentially, that then that poses a risk in prisons. The reality in the UK, for example, is that actually trans prisoners who want to move from the women's estate to the men's estate and vice versa. There is a process that they go through, and that process is supposed to vet them and look at their offending patterns, for example. That has clearly failed in certain cases, because I described them in the book. There was a case of that happening. So that sounds to me like institutional failure, as there often is, right, in terms of prison governance, whether, you know, not a failing of, I don't know, the trans movement and what it's asking for in terms of depathologizing the process by which we are recognized by the state, if that makes sense.
Yes. The existence of trans people in prison in no way has any significant bearing on the pre-existing problems that exist in prison. And if we're going to, we need to address the pre-existing problems that exist with prison, is really the only way to address any of these sort of like, subcategory problems. Because they're really not subcategory problems. They're problems with prison. It seems to me. It's just
I mean, I was just going to say that, you know, I don't mean this is a cheap gotcha. Like, oh, you don't care about male guards, but male guards are, you know, there are plenty of instances, I'm sure, in the US and definitely in the UK, of, like, for example, cis male prison staff having inappropriate relationships with, like, female prisoners, for example. And I'm not saying, oh, you can't care about both things, but there is no vociferous campaign I have seen.
Something like, I've seen 20 to 40%. 20 to 40% of women in prison are, and obviously it happens to cis men in all male prisons as well. But yeah, it is sort of shocking to me that there is this level of concern about the potential for trans cis rape as opposed to cis rape, which is very well documented.
I mean, the contradiction's obvious. I just also want to point out another piece of hypocrisy, which is bodily autonomy for one's like decision not to get vaccinated or not. But when it comes to one taking their health care into their own hands and choosing to transition, that is something that the state needs to get involved in.
Right. Well, let's talk about some of the other sort of like headline rhetorical, I guess, issues. And that is, we've talked ad nauseum to the question of sports here. let's talk specifically about puberty blockers and surgeries. We had a situation where somebody in custody now for calling in a bomb threat to one of the most, I think, renowned children's hospitals in the country that provides pediatric health care. They also provide health care for children who are trans or who may are questioning whether they should transition or to slow down puberty or whatever it is. What do you make of this angle, I guess, in, you know, that both this is the predation on children and children, and I guess ostensibly their parents don't have the ability to determine what kind of healthcare they need.
Yeah, well, the protection of children and women and children, you know, more paternalistically, but let's say children, the protection of children has always been one of the most powerfully anti-queer, anti-LGBTQ forms, you know, rhetorical tools for hugely reactionary and usually quite systemically violent responses to LGBT people. Why? Because everyone who considers themselves a decent person wants to protect children. It's a very like easy rallying emotive cry that would tap at most people into most people's, sense of like morality. However, where it becomes skewed is that, when it comes to conservatives, the protection of children tends to be like framed as we are protecting children from an ideology, a group that is spreading a social contagion, predatory gay adults, trans adults who are trying to recruit them. Whereas the reality is all the evidence shows, right, is that the biggest risk to LGBT kids comes from like bigoted adults. to their mental well-being, to their like to their safety, whether it's their parents, whether it's their teachers. And so this idea of the protection of children is one that like people can have very different ideas, and they can be talking about that and mean very different things. And with regards to trans young people and trans children, I think we're in the state of what I think is a moral panic. And I talk about moral panic theory in the book. Like very similar to, for example, the satanic panic or other scares amongst about young people. Because the disproportionate focus on the treatment of like a very small number of trans young people whose gender dysphoria is so acute that they feel distressed by their like the development of their secondary sex characteristics in puberty, that it's worth it, you know, for them suppressing it. That will not even be all trans young people. Some trans young people don't feel that level of distress, and a lot of trans people will only come to the realization they're trans long after their puberty is really you know, begun or even finished. So this is a very small number of people. Like in the UK, where obviously we've had quite a big moral panic about this, I say there are 12 million children in England, where I live, 12 million children, and under 16, 95 of those children were on puberty blockers at the time I wrote the book in like 2019, like 95 out of 12 million. And the disproportionate levels of media coverage that this got, I think the other thing that's worth saying, right, is that a lot of these treatments, so for example, puberty blockers that have become so apparently controversial, were developed for cisgender children who usually for precocious puberty. That precocious puberty is a natural variation where puberty occurs younger than the child's peers. And, you know, for reasons of like, alleviation of psychological distress, feeling self-conscious, puberty will be like temporarily slowed down or paused. And that's how it was used since the 1970s. And it's only since the 90s anywhere in the world it's been used on trans young people. And so for me, I find it quite like startling that this like moral panic has arisen about potentially whether or not doctors are competent to prescribe this, whether or not young people are competent to, or their parents on their behalf are competent to give consent to the treatment, when in fact this has been a treatment that's been used since the 1970s. So, you know, coming up like 50 years on cisgender young people. And it shows to me a kind of double standard that when we look at trans healthcare, it tends to be both for children and for adults sensationalized. Trans people's agency is immediately removed and it's problematized because it seemed to be about gender. It's not seen to be about real healthcare. And that's where I see the link, you know, with abortion, is that I think in the US, you can probably see now that probably there was a liberal consensus for a while that every woman has a right to an abortion. And it's been quite jarring around the world to see that the growth of the belief that that is not the case, that every woman has a right to autonomy of her body in that way. But that there clearly has been a working, growing and politically potent movement seen to curbing that idea and that principle. Yeah, to me, they seem like it seems inherently linked, that this is about, as I said earlier, bodily autonomy, and about the fact that like we are able to do what we want with our own bodies under a patriarchal system, that you should not be compelled to participate in gender with your body in any way that you don't want to. And that the arguments that it's natural or, you know, ordained by God, or, you know, that you're messing around with hormones, or that you're messing around with, you know, bodily integrity, these are like misogynist. They've always been misogynistic, and they are also deeply transphobic and harmful arguments. And yeah, I think the other thing to say with kids is that I think there's been a lot of anxieties that have been stoked. So, for example, a lot of, in the UK, we have some like gay and lesbian adults who are very gender nonconforming. For example, you know, there might be butch women, very femme gay men, for example, who remember being very gender nonconforming children and are of the belief that they would have been quote unquote trans now had they grown up now, that there is a kind of conveyor belt for any gender nonconforming child into medical transition. I feel that that is like ludicrous. I felt like when I often was speaking about it in the UK, I had to treat it with a bit more sincerity. But, you know, it's worth saying it's a ludicrous notion that the idea that you are, certainly in the UK, and I imagine it's like the the same in most states in the US, that you are suddenly whisked off and given all of these drugs and surgeries the minute that you like do something a bit gender nonconforming, like play with a doll if you're a boy, or climb a tree in dungarees if you're a girl. It's just nonsense. Like, most parents do, you know, are not prepared, even when they do have a trans child, for a trans child. And I can say personally that as someone that, like, you know, was misconstrued as potentially a feminine gay boy when I was like an adolescent, people were very keen that I like really try and stick with that and not transition. And I think that's, it's fair to say that that's the general rule of where society is with the acceptance of trans people. And I don't know any trans person that believes that you can't be a cisgender person and very gender nonconforming. Like, trans people I know at least tend to be, you know, there might be some with very conservative ideas about gender, obviously, because we're a diverse group, but most of us accept, like, you know, I get, like, I have gay male friends who wear dresses. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't think a man in a dress needs to transition.
Well, you're doing a poor job of pushing the trans agenda in that instance. So. Well, listen, it's fascinating stuff. Can't recommend the book highly enough. We will put a link to the transgender issue. Trans justice is justice for all. Sean Fay, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about it. Hope to talk to you again soon about more of these things, because I think this is as a rhetorical bludgeon and an electoral device, at least in this country, it is not going away. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota's 5th Congressional District. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. I want to welcome back to the program Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota's 5th Congressional District. Congresswoman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
We get a bunch of stuff that we want to talk to you about. but let's start with student debt, because I know you're deeply involved in this. I think since the last time we spoke to you, well, it's certainly been since the last time we spoke to you. Sure, you're aware. President Biden found it. I mean, I think the last time we spoke, we were asking where the memo was from the Department of Education. I don't even know what the stat. They found it, and it turns out he can do it, and he did it at least to some degree. $10,000 for everyone under. Making under $125,000 as an individual, $250,000 for a couple, $20,000 if you were the recipient of a Pell Grant. I have a sense, I know the answer to this question, but what do you think about that debt relief?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I've been a champion in trying to get complete student debt cancellation, but this is significant. 43 million of the 45 million who have student debt will feel some relief. 20 million of those will have their student debt wiped out. And so, you know, the day that it was announced, I was getting text messages from people who in my district who have been part of that movement, who've been campaigning alongside me to try to get student debt cancellation, in tears, because, you know, the amount of debt that they had would ultimately be canceled by the time this is processed. So we are grateful that the president, one, did find the memo, that he did carry out the promise he made to me end of March when I met with him in the White House, that he will move some sort of student debt cancellation, and ultimately did keep his campaign promise.
Do you think that's the end of it? I mean, because I have to, or let me ask you a subsidiary question. Do you think they were surprised at how little pushback there was? I mean, it seemed like it was a story in the news for, I don't know, 36 hours, 48 hours. Obviously, it helped his in the polls. I mean, I think there's like direct evidence of that, that his approval rating went up, particularly amongst young people. It's probably going to help the Democrats writ large in November. But in terms of pushback, it seemed to have gone away. Like, there was a, you know, Ted Cruz went out there and said, you know, why are we giving basket weavers, you know, a majors? And then they realized, like, oh my God, it turns out there's 45 million basket weavers in this country. Maybe we shouldn't be doing this. Like, do you think they were A, surprised by the lack of pushback, and B, do you have a sense that, like, there's going to be a sequel?
So I don't know if the White House itself was surprised. I think they've been clearly paying attention to the polls and knew that this was significantly going to be helpful to the president and to the Democrats in general going into this midterms. But I know that some of our colleagues in Congress who said, you know, this would be the end of us were surprised that there was a minimal pushback and that the talking points that the Republicans had ultimately fell apart. Now, you know, the only thing that they have left to say is that we've taken away their recruitment tool for recruiting for the military, which is the most ridiculously obvious.
I mean, it's probably true a little bit.
You shouldn't say that out loud and like they're telling them themselves. And I think that response in itself is helpful to us because what we are recognizing, I think, as Democrats collectively, including the president and the administration, is that when we do the right thing in helping working people in this country and the working poor, that those policies really do impact the election, get people on our side. And it is not okay for always to make promises to people and fall short on those promises. And this is, you know, this has to usher in a new era of Democrats fulfilling the promises that they make on the campaign trail when they are given the opportunity to legislate.
You know, I think we've had a conversation in the past too, where we talked about there's some members of your fellow Democrats who are not always necessarily sincere about being supportive of something, et cetera, et cetera. You say that there are some of your colleagues who were surprised at the lack of pushback. How earnest was their fear of an electoral pushback? And to the extent that they were earnest about that fear, how much do you think that, like, this example showing them, like, hey, this actually is helpful electorally, like, what percentage of those people out there could it actually move in Congress, as opposed to, like, I'm saying I'm afraid of the electoral pushback because I really don't like the idea of us not, you know, maintaining the exploitive power of keeping people in debt?
I think a lot of them are earnest in their fear that some of these policies, right, that are pushed by young people who are not reliable voters when it comes to elections would create a backlash from their reliable voting base. And so I do hope that, you know, in November, we actually do have a huge turnout in young people voting so that they can see that they, you know, that there was an impact in the election by student debt cancellation as well.
Well, I mean, and it seems like the White House is kind of starting to understand that this is the time to put your foot on the gas a little bit, because the Republicans, what are they running on? Transphobia and Dr. Seuss, right? Like, they're a bit on the back foot. And so I was really happy that in the House, Pelosi and you all prioritized passing legislation like codifying abortion and marriage equality. And right now, Chuck Schumer seems to be kind of trying, and the bipartisan coalition, they seem to be trying to wrangle the votes to hold a vote on marriage equality. Now, I'm a little concerned that Republicans are going to try to stall. I think you should just hold the vote right away and make someone like Ron Johnson say, take a vote on it in a tough election. What's your stance on that? I know that the House did, you did your job there, but are you hoping that the Senate can just push this through? Because if Republicans want to vote against marriage equality in the year 2022, I want to make them take that vote.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I think we should make them take the vote. But I certainly also could understand that there is an actual path for it passing, and it would mean a significant deal to so many families that are feeling uncertain right now, certainly to a lot of the families that I just spoke with at the HRC gala in Minneapolis. This is, you know, my family isn't threatened by any legislation that, you know, that we're waiting on. And I know that there are a lot of families who are. And so if there is a path forward in trying to get it codified, I want them to be able to explore that. You know, the new talking point for the Democrats is that we're going to put people over politics. And this is certainly one of those cases where we have to make sure that the politics of the day does not kill legislation that has the ability to become law.
I don't like the rap that politics is getting in that. Why can't we say electoral politics? Because it's all politics, right? I mean, you know, it's regardless of those 10 Republicans who hopefully will show up after the election as opposed to before, it's still on, you know, for halfway at least for them a political calculation as to how they're going to vote. But I am with you in that it's sort of like a tough decision. You're having to trust that the 10 are going to show up afterwards. And I would imagine, you know, Tammy Baldwin has had conversations that, you know, lead her to believe that that's the best opportunity. She's spearheading that effort in the Senate to the extent that I'm aware of. And it's a tough call.
And in many ways, it's hard to judge, right? Because I know that it is more personal for her than it is for me. And that's why I started that conversation with that, because for people who many of the policies that we vote on is personal, you have to trust when they tell you, you know, I think I can get the votes, let me try it. And I'm going to trust the senator that she does believe she has the votes and wants to give her colleagues the time and the ability to come to that decision.
I have some more questions about legislation, but first I want to just ask about the nurses' strike. Minnesota saw the largest strike of private nurses, I think, in the country. In the country ever.
Yeah.
Last week? Yes. Okay. And 14,000 to 15,000 nurses went on strike for 3 days. Give us a sense of like where things stand with that and what kind of support there was for the nurses there, because this feels like part of a burgeoning sort of reemergence of labor's understanding of their power.
Yeah, having 15,000 nurses go on strike, it was historic and significant. I think it does have a clear impact on the labor movement. Right now, that power was recognized by executives in the healthcare industry in Minnesota. So they are re-entering negotiations. I hope that they carry out those negotiations in good faith and that nurses get what they are owed. These are people who, without them, the healthcare system wouldn't work. Without them, patients wouldn't get the care that they need. And without them, you know, I don't know where many of us would be when we show up to seek care. And so the level of support from all levers of power in Minnesota was tremendous. We had myself, the governor, almost every single person, you know, on the Democrat side, obviously, who holds office, come out on the picket line with them. As someone who's been part of a union who went on strike few times, I don't remember us receiving that level of significant of support. And so I know it made the nurses feel really good that every single person was out there supporting them.
What's the sense in the general population? Because, you know, I mean, it's a slightly different dynamic. But I just remember we had a subway strike here or a bus strike. When was it, like maybe 8 years ago, 10 years ago? I can't remember now. And there was animosity. I don't know what the polling.
Yeah,
say,
I mean, but
I'm just curious as to like what's your sense of like what the general population, how, you know, how are they reacting to a strike like that? I guess it was in 2005. I'm old, so I know it was like 8 years ago. It was actually 15, 17 years ago. Oh God! But anyways,
I feel that way too. The last two times I personally worked in a unionized workplace where we striked was 2008 and 2009. I always say, you know, a couple years ago, but it's not now. It feels that way. But oftentimes, as you are aware of, Sam, when folks go on strike, there is an ask to the public not to cross the picket line, right? And to help with that movement. But in this case, because they are striking a healthcare facility,
right,
they were asking for people to continue to seek care. And so the public were in full support. I don't think I've heard in the news or just talking to people any sort of pushback from the public. People understood why it was important for nurses to have a decent schedule, staffing level that is sustainable for them to be paid well. These are people that we've hailed as heroes and said they were essential workers. And it's not okay for us to just, you know, fly a balloon that says celebrate our heroes. We have to give them a hero's pay and make sure that they are getting a hero's dignified workplace.
Turning back to legislation, I don't know how many signatories there are now, but there are at least, I guess, 45, 50 signatories on a letter written by your colleague, Raul Grevalla, about the Joe Manchin side deal. This is the permitting deal that he made with Chuck Schumer. They're trying to put it into the continuing resolution. Like, where does that stand now? And what, I mean, really, like, at what point, like, how much, and I imagine this is going to come from the Progressive Caucus, how much of a will is there to sink the continuing resolution in the event that it is stuck into the continuing resolution?
Yeah. Chairman Grijalva is, as you know, a former chair of the Progressive Caucus. There's a conversation that is continuing to be had with leadership in the House and the Senate to try to make sure that we get a clean CR. Keeping the government functioning and open is definitely something I think everybody wants to see. And there is no reason for there to be a CR that faces the threat of not passing that would ultimately lead to a government shutdown. And again, if we were to be political, we're 50 days from the election in November in a midterm year where we are desperately trying to keep the House and the Senate and continue to pass legislation that will be impactful in people's lives. This is not the time to take that risk. And so I know that many of us who are signatories of that letter have made that clear. And our hope is that leadership listens.
Well, I mean, Manchin has burned you guys on your side before in the midst of the negotiations on Build Back Better, which he essentially killed. And the Inflation Reduction Act is the shadow of that. But is there a desire on your guys' part in the CPC to essentially say, hey, you broke your promise on the Senate end. We're not going to cave to this because this is an agreement that Schumer and Manchin made behind closed doors. You did not agree to this. So attaching a pipeline piece of legislation to the continuing resolution to keep the government funded, you guys had no part of that. So in my opinion, you're under no obligation to agree to it.
Yeah, and I think that is what the letter makes it clear to leadership, and I think it's important to also understand, right? This is not a funding bill that would have, you know, policies for the future. This is literally seeing the government shut down, and so this is significant. I think it's imperative for leadership to understand what they're putting at risk at this moment.
All right. So obviously, like this is a silent of a negotiation as can be because of those political constraints. But does, and maybe it's easier to talk about hypothetically, in a situation like this, what's going on in terms of like there is a cohort in the House that is saying to Pelosi, we don't want this in the continuing resolution. Schumer is telling Pelosi, we need this. I would imagine part of the calculation is if Joe Manchin is so vital after November 8th, chances are the House is lost anyways, right? And if Joe Manchin is less vital because maybe there's been two pickups in the Senate, that's more likely than the House has a better chance of being held, right? I mean, are these part of the calculations that people are making in terms of like, how much are we going to kowtow to Joe Manchin here? And, you know, on one hand, on the other hand, how much are we not going to shoot ourselves in the foot because we want to win the House, and the shutting down of government just gives us bad press for a week, 4 weeks out from the election? And how much somewhere in between there does it become like, just give him his pipeline in West Virginia, give him his pipeline that he so desperately wants, make it seem like it's a policy, but it's basically just a giveaway so that he can be paid off because that's the way that this guy operates. My words, not yours. How much, what goes on in a more hypothetical situation in this, a situation that looks very much like this, hypothetically speaking?
Hypothetically speaking, right. there are deals that constantly have to be made in order for pieces of legislation to be passed when you have the sort of slim majorities that we have. And I think part of this calculation is sort of also thinking about, you know, what happens with Senator Bernie Sanders in the Senate. Do they have the numbers to pass CR that you know allows for this deal to be made for Manchin? And how much of a significant negotiation could be done with Senator Bernie Sanders in the Senate? And so I know that leadership has to hold a lot, and there's a lot that the Progressive Caucus has to think about. There's a lot of levers, and you know, time will tell where things end up being. And I do just want to say, you know, when you are thinking about a CR, which is a continuing resolution for those that are listening, because we haven't had the ability to pass an actual budget in Congress for a really long time. So we do these continuing resolutions, right, that say government should be funded the way that it was funded last time, which has been the case for a long time now. That's people's paychecks. That's, you know, a lot of the essential needs that people need is Social Security and everything else that goes along with it. And so there's a lot to think about when you're thinking about a government shutdown. Even if it's shut down for 2-3 days, what are you coming back to negotiate? Is also something that we have to think about outside of the politics of what it means in November. We also have to think about what it means for people's lives. And I think that in many ways, a lot of us want to make sure that there is no disruption in people's lives as much as possible.
A tangential issue to this is the leadership. I'm old. I remembered the transit strike in 2005, and I thought it was in 2012. But I also remember the last time that Nancy Pelosi was looking for votes for leadership, she made a vow that she would not seek leadership after this term of the House. What is there any word on, like, has she forgotten that vow? Do you know if is there talk? I mean, do questions like this continuing resolution thing come into it? I mean, are those part of the negotiations? I mean, where does that stand? Hypothetically,
those are not part of negotiations for a CR and keeping the government open.
Right.
Thankfully, I don't really know because again, right, most of us are concerned about whether we keep the House or not, and you know what ultimately happens will allow for us to have that conversation. I can't say that I've heard a single conversation where the speaker is seeking another term as speaker or minority leader, God forbid. And so my assumption at the moment is that promise is probably still being kept.
Well, hypothetically, again, does someone in the Congressional Progressive Caucus have designs on maybe making a run for the speakership in the event that hypothetically someone named Hakeem Jeffries is being lined up as the person who's going to take over for Nancy Pelosi? Again, we're just asking hypotheticals.
Hypothetically. between now and November, I have, I think, multiple schedules with folks that are seeking those positions. So hypothetically, there's a lot of people being considered within the Progressive Caucus for positions of leadership.
And let's just turn to the fall. Like, have you noticed a change in terms of, like, on the ground? And obviously, you know, your district is pretty blue. But have you noticed any type of change over the course of this year in terms of, like, where you have become more optimistic about the chances to hold the House?
Yes, we have more seats that are Democratic toss-up than we did, say, June. Right now in the polls, in Minnesota, a lot of our the seats that, you know, we would be worried about are doing better. In the polls, there's a lot more conversations about what the overturning of Roe means and how much it's activating people to get involved. Yesterday, I was out door knocking the University of Minnesota, and almost every single student I talked to said they weren't planning on voting and registering, but they are registered now and they're voting, and their number one issue is abortion. Wow. And so, you know, for a lot of people that sort of don't think about midterms, a lot of people that move to a new neighborhood or a new state or a city that, you know, don't want to take the time to do this, they are certainly motivated. And I think that there is a positive shift for Democrats this year. Former President Bill Clinton said something about, you know, Republicans closed strong and we shouldn't take their record of closing strong and finding some weird thing to fearmonger around for granted. And I think that message is clearly being heard, and Democrats are ready, I think, to counter a lot of the fearmongering that Republicans do towards the election day.
All right, and this is the last question, I promise. Is there any talk about the DCCC chair? A lot of people are very critical of Sean Maloney for essentially abandoning his existing district and coming in and bigfooting Mondaire Jones in his district. We're the net is the loss of a progressive congressperson in the House. Is there concern amongst your colleagues? I mean, this guy's supposed to be building, you know, like helping Democrats as opposed to sort of using his authority to sort of squeeze some out.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of conversations. A lot of people have been openly critical. And I'll just say my computer is about to go to sleep. There's like 5% left. Sorry, I didn't come prepared. I know many people can relate to this. But there's a lot of conversations. And again, as I said, you know, our calendars are filled with people who are seeking to hold different leadership positions. And there's just a lot of movement in the Democratic caucus right now in trying to see how we can shake up the leadership positions that exist and have new voices and new blood in there.
Representative Ilhan Omar, Minnesota's 5th Congressional District, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. Not that that wasn't fun.
Very fun.
It's a muscle flexing half. A
lot of hypothetical.
Really good show today.
It was a good show today.
Woo.
We got into hypotheticals and a lot of thought experiments. I mean, I think, you know, it is the implications of a government shutdown, I think, you know, for some people, it can just read like, oh, government shutdown, it's just words in a paper, in the newspaper or on the internets. But it also, I don't know. I'm glad I don't have to make that.
Those are the limits of, you know, of flexing your muscle, right? And trying to secure things like no pipeline being built through West Virginia, then it comes, it bumps up against people's actual lives being immediately impacted.
Yeah.
So
Militant Apathy on the IM says she sounds like a real politician now, LOL. KG. People forget this.
That wasn't KG at all.
Well, no. I mean, she definitely is very, you know, specific. Ooh. With what she'll say, but people forget she was the Speaker of the House in Minnesota, or was she
or the whip?
There she was, the whip. I mean, she was not a political neophyte when she came into Congress. She was a politician.
I'm sorry, but like you'll listen to any other political interview. We got some actually good nuggets there that aren't going to be reflected in by other people.
Without a doubt. But I think that's sometimes people forget, like, because as a member of the squad, she and Rashida Tlaib were in their state
houses.
Senate state yeah. houses. And there's it's a different, you know, they're practiced politicians.
It's also a good thing to have someone on our side who's doing politics.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she was assistant minority leader for the DFL caucus in
that's,
Minnesota.
You know, yeah. In Minnesota, that's, I mean, you're doing politics there.
Yeah.
Also a North Dakota State University graduate.
Whoa.
So,
oh.
Go Bison.
I didn't know that.
Oh, well, obviously, Matt did not know that. You're beaming.
I
think a lot of state pride there going on there.
I NDSU, go Bison.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. When you become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, you not only help the show survive and thrive, you also get the free half free of commercials. Even though you can go and look in the podcast or YouTube description and find those links there. Some people complain about it. I don't get to hear Sam's meandering stories about some of these products. We use all the products here, incidentally. There is no product that we don't. well, I'm not going to wait for our fast growing trees at, but we use all the products here. And also, you get the fun half. So become a member today. Don't forget the Discord, Majority Discord. We got over 7,000 teeming Discord members. Also, amquickie.com. Get you the top three or four or five stories from a lefty perspective in your email box every morning. amquickie.com. And justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Today is Monday, ladies and gentlemen. This is a big day for sports wrap-ups.
Yeah. ESPN today, 4 p.m., streaming on the Majority Report channel. Right here you can find us. We're going to be talking about Jeff Bezos sitting pretty cozily next to Roger Goodell on Thursday Night Football, plus a recap of the weekend, including victories by both New York teams. What the hell is going on with the Broncos?
You guys should do a segment where it's like the Jets and Giants fan react to how the week went.
Yeah, we really should.
Specifically package it like that.
Joe from Seattle said, shout out to my friend Phil listening in Cleveland, whose weekend was ruined by Majority Report producer Bradley Alsop when he tweeted the very offensive message, God loves the New York Jets. I don't follow too much football, but I thought everyone agreed not to be a Jets fan.
I mean, man, if that's how God shows his love, he really is a vindictive, cruel man.
I'm like Job.
He's a man?
I guess. In this scenario, he is a vindictive man.
Old Testament God's a Jets fan.
Right. For the Jets, definitely an Old Testament God, no question.
So yeah, check that out. And we're on Mondays now.
YouTube.com/ESPN show for clips.
Thank you. And five stars on podcast.
Five
podcasts.
Stars on
that's
Spotify
all.
And
that's
Apple
all.
Podcasts.
Sorry,
please.
Go Matt.
speaking of Minnesota and Minneapolis, tomorrow night, Left Reckoning at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, the YouTube channel, we're to have GP Jacob, the host of Money, Power, Land Solidarity podcast, to talk about rent control in that city particularly and some other topics. But particularly, they passed rent control through a referendum, but now they have a working group that's going to take a really close eye on it, and that working group has some good activists on it and a lot of just absolute industry, real estate industry plants. Mm. So we're going to talk about how we go from referendum to whatever's going on with rent control in Minneapolis now. So check that out.
Bob Carmody, your test worked. We should just let you know that on the IM. Fierce Deity said, for Congresswoman Omar's sake, I think it's important to remind everybody this whole show is parody and nobody can be held responsible for anything they say. We actually, when I first got to Air America, there was a real concern because we're FCC and we're national, and we used to do a liner on it where I was saying, like, I said, like, I'm a satirist. I mean, that's my whole career has been satire.
Mm.
And so I had Benjamin record a liner that said something like, at the opening of the show, everything that you hear is satire for the sake of any potential future litigation.
Oh, yeah. I think I saw that liner on like one of your drop boxes or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, that was what it was. And I said that to everybody, you know, to like the execs at Air America. And they just looked at me and they're like, maybe that could work.
Yeah. It's called plausible deniability.
646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Who?
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Keen.
You did it!
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
All right, me. make think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start life.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge me.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. You call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about yeah. you is just like every day, all day, yeah. like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the wheat being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow.
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.